You are listening to National Security Law Today.
This is National Security Law Today, the podcast of the Standing Committee on Law and National Security. I'm Elisa Poteet, always here in my individual capacity. And today we're returning to the topic of IEPA. That sounds like some sort of Swiss yodel, but it isn't. It's nothing more than an acronym for the International Emergency Economic Powers Act. Most recently, it's been used to justify a wide array of tariffs on all manner of goods and commodities against countries large and small, some of whom we have a trade imbalance with. But there are others where they're taking in far more American goods than the other way around. And so query what the emergency is. Nevertheless, the VOS case, the one that is headed for the Supreme Court in early November, was brought by several companies who challenged the legality of IEPA's application to tariffs. The Court of Appeals for the Federal Circuit's opinions, and there were two, right per curiam and dissent, they were, well, astonishingly thoughtful and not decided along party lines. Now, before the court hears the case, which is going to be November 3rd or 5th, it's important to level set and talk about IEPA's traditional uses, its origins, and the current processes in place, bearing in mind that heretofore, tariffs were not really part of IEPA's array of tools, or so we thought. But we're questioning a lot these days, and there is a lot of upending of norms. So one of the best people to discuss this, of course, would be former OFAC chief counsel Rachel Alpert, who's now a partner at Jenner & Block. Hey, thank you so much for coming in, Rachel. The people who worked for you thought you were just awesome, and we're really glad to have you.
Thank you so much. It's great to be here.
All right, let's go to absolute basics. Not every listener is going to be a lawyer. Maybe it's a first-year law student. Maybe it's a journalist who wants to be smart when they're talking. But what is OFAC?
So OFAC is the Office of Foreign Assets Control, which is an office at the Treasury Department. And this is the office that develops, administers, implements, and enforces U.S. sanctions. It currently sits under the Undersecretary for Terrorism and Financial Intelligence. But the office has a really neat history, and I love sanctions history. This starts back in 1940, when Germany invaded Norway and Denmark. President Roosevelt issued an executive order that basically sought to protect the assets of those countries that were in the United States from Germany, so that Germany wouldn't have access to them, and they needed somebody to lead that effort. That's when Treasury's Foreign Funds Control Unit was created. Now, this Foreign Funds Control Unit was OFAC's predecessor. Some refer to it just as the control, which has made its way onto some mugs within OFAC. And from that time forward, the control administered the sanctions that were blocking these assets. After World War II, this all morphed because we were starting the Cold War. So sanctions turned into sanctions primarily against communism. And that's when Treasury established the Division of Foreign Assets Control. So it wasn't the office at that point to administer all of the communism sanctions related assets. This is around 1950. And then finally, the Office of Foreign Assets Control was established in 1962.
That's an interesting history. And you're speaking to somebody who actually attended high school in Norway. And one of the histories that I learned was that the Nazis actually occupied the country. I don't think that's something that was taught to me in American school, but they never forgot in Norway, and they never really forgot their relationship with us, and they remain great NATO partners. They currently have a sovereign wealth fund that is very controversial right now in terms of some of the choices that it's making, and I'm tracking that very closely in the FD. That's a great tidbit. So what is IEPA? It sounds like a yodel.
Yeah, well, it has a lot of vowels in that acronym. So as you mentioned, IEPA stands for the International Emergency Economic Powers Act. This was passed in 1977, which was the year after Congress passed the National Emergencies Act. Overall, it was intended as a successor to the Trading with the Enemy Act, although it didn't get rid of what we call TWEA, but it was intended as kind of the new authority that would be used for sanctions purposes and the sorts of things that TWEA had been used for previously. Together with the National Emergencies Act, IEPA was intended to help place some new limits on presidential emergency powers and also just generally provide the framework going forward for sanctions. And so with the National Emergencies Act, it added some new limits to what could be done, primarily requiring reports, like reports when a new national emergency was declared to Congress, a report when a national emergency is terminated, annual reports about the different national emergencies, and actual presidential affirmative renewal of each national emergency every year so that national emergencies didn't continue indefinitely without any sort of affirmative decision to keep them going. So it provided a little bit more in terms of oversight. It also gave Congress the authority ultimately to terminate a national emergency via joint resolution. And overall, it provided a little more congressional oversight, but in the end, probably not a lot of congressional action in that space. The one thing to highlight, and I think this is important in terms of understanding what the crux is of the IEPA authority, it basically allows the president to declare a national emergency to deal with an unusual and extraordinary threat that has its source in whole or substantial part outside the U.S. to the national security, foreign policy, or economy of the United States. So every national emergency declared under IEPA needs to meet that criteria in order to qualify as a legal national emergency under the act.
But I hear some language in the disjunctive. It's sort of or the economy, or is it and the economy?
It's an or. So you'll see some national emergency declarations address one piece of that or another. They don't always include all of those magic words. And that's okay, as long as it's among those three things, that's something that would be within scope.
Well, maybe we can hold that thought, because I know that that was part of the basis for the tariffs, was that it linked to the economy and an imbalance in trade. But let's talk about possible other uses of IEPA beyond sanctions before now, because this was a sea change, I think, in terms of what we thought of. When I think of IEPA, I think of sanctions, period, like the Iran sanctions or even the Cuba sanctions, or the stuff that comes to mind immediately, especially the long-term ones, are the ones that sort of go in and out depending upon who the ruler of a country is and how much of a threat they present. So what were those other uses before now?
Yeah, well, just an aside, interestingly, Cuba is the only sanctions program that remains based on TWIA. So this dates back to the 1960s. So that's a really interesting tidbit. But Iran was actually the first set of sanctions issued under IEPA in 1979. But there have been uses of IEPA that are not purely sanctions related, but usually they're in a space that I would consider essentially sanctions adjacent. So for example, Commerce Department's Bureau of Industry and Security administers the Export Administration Regulations. And historically, they would be based on a statute called the Export Administration Act, but that lapsed periodically. It had a sunset date. And Congress, surprisingly, wouldn't always get its act together to renew it in a timely manner. And so then if there was no law in place, export controls would simply lapse. That was something that IEPA was used for, to basically fill in the gaps. And this was done periodically until export control reform happened with the Export Control Reform Act, which allows now exports to last indefinitely. But IEPA was the basis of the EAR, the Export Administration Regulations, when there was no other law to serve as its basis. So that's one example. Another is the Outbound Investment Security Program that was established in August 2023. This is a program that's administered by the Treasury Department, although a different office than administers sanctions. And so that deals with requirements associated with outbound investment from the United States. And then a DOJ-administered program relates to bulk-sensitive personal data, and that's also an IEPA-based program that imposes requirements associated with bulk-sensitive personal data, again, involving threats to the national security of the United States.
Got it. Let's talk a bit about executive orders that have been issued over the years to support any sanctions and sort of how they relate to IEPA or underpin it, if that's the case.
Yeah, so pretty much every sanctions executive order, if you look at that first paragraph, it refers to the National Emergencies Act and the International Emergency Economic Powers Act. Those are the two key laws that are the foundation of every sanctions executive order. And there have been a lot of them declared over the years. I should say every sanctions executive order, except the ones prior to AIPA, like the Cuba one, which is based in a number of other laws. And so there are a number of different categories that these executive orders fall into that address different types of national emergencies. So for example, there are some that are kind of pretty broad sweeping country or government specific executive orders. Those address national emergencies related to some action that the government of a country has taken. For example, there's the North Korea sanctions program, which is quite broad. There are the Iran sanctions, which are also quite broad. There are also sanctions with respect to the government of Venezuela, Russia sanctions, which were increased and increased. So that's one category of sanctions that might get issued pursuant to AIPA based on an executive order. Other categories of sanctions, again, based on AIPA executive orders, that might also pull in other laws. So oftentimes, Congress might pass a law that relates in some way to sanctions. They might even specifically refer to AIPA in the law and direct the president to use all authorities authorized under AIPA to address a national emergency. Then the executive order itself will refer both to the law and to AIPA. And so some of these subject-related sanctions programs are things that are based on the Global Magnitsky Act, which relates to human rights violations and abuses. And then the sanctions program relates to serious human rights abuse and corruption. There are counter-narcotics sanctions based on executive orders, sanctions to counter-terrorism. And then what I think of as the third bucket of sanctions, again, from AIPA-based executive orders, are those that are list-based sanctions programs. So they're intended to target a specific national emergency in a country, but it doesn't sanction the whole country. It's not targeting a whole area of a subject matter, but it's rather sanctions against those who are responsible for, say, committing atrocities somewhere or carrying out some other bad action. So those types of things I think of, like the sanctions program that relates to the Democratic Republic of the Congo or the Sudan or Darfur related sanctions. And so there are a number of different ways that sanctions are imposed from these executive orders, but the consistent feature of all of them is that they're all based on AIPA, among other laws.
And you mentioned one thing, and I'd like for you to put a little bit more detail on that, because I think it might be confusing to people who haven't seen it or experienced it. But you mentioned that there were times when Congress would enact a law, and I believe that Congress enacted something along the lines of Iran, right? When Obama was president and maybe had lifted some sanctions to bring the Iranians to the table, and Congress said, well, pump the brakes. You know, we believe that you should go after them anyway, or words to that effect, trying to order the president to do what?
There have been a number of laws related to Iran sanctions, but one of them, the Comprehensive Iran Sanctions Accountability and Divestment Act, required what we refer to as a much broader array of sanctions. So I think that primarily imposed sanctions on persons determined to engage in sanctionable activities in a lot of different areas, and also expanded the scope of what we call secondary sanctions. And so secondary sanctions are sanctions that are not on the country itself, but are on those that are supporting the country in some way. And so the idea is that by providing support to Iran, like through its oil program, that these entities or these countries are also creating harm or threats to U.S. national security and foreign policy. And so CISADA, this law that was passed under the Obama administration, sought to really go after that broader array of behavior.
And that makes perfect sense because, I mean, an economy always drives a country and empowers whoever's in charge, even if they're a massive national security threat. I'd like to talk about how the sanctions process normally works. But as part of that conversation, I'd like to understand how much evidence of a national emergency is required before Treasury would sign off on sanctions, because there's something called a packet, right?
Yeah, so let me break down the different steps to implementing sanctions, because there's the step of declaring the national emergency, and then there's the step of actually identifying sanctions targets and applying the sanctions. So the first step, this executive order step, is the point at which the president will identify the threat to the national security, foreign policy, or economy of the United States. And in that executive order, it'll describe the threat, and then it'll identify the specific actions that agencies should take to address that threat. So that's the section of the executive order that will assign, usually it's designation authority, so the authority to identify and sanction specific targets, to the Secretary of the Treasury or sometimes the Secretary of State or sometimes both. Once an executive order is issued, then it's up to those respective agencies, and I'll focus on Treasury and OFAC's role there since that's the one I've worked with most recently. They will look at the criteria that are laid out in the executive order to identify targets that meet those criteria. And that's when the process of putting together the evidentiary package really comes into play. So people aren't just sanctioned without any basis. There's a whole process of collecting information and drafting an evidentiary memorandum that provides the underlying evidence and the justification and support for a specific sanctions designation. Then that goes to the OFAC director who signs off on the action. And then at that point, it will be publicized. It'll be listed on the SDN list. There will be a press release identifying that the action has happened and describing its basis. And then the sanctions are out in the world.
And as a practice matter, there's also a way to be notified of an update to designations or sanctions. And Treasury must have some sort of a bot that can shoot out to lawyers or journalists who would be interested in doing that. And how would they do that?
So I subscribe to OFAC's recent actions notices. That's the first point of notification that OFAC has taken an action. So that'll tell you every time there's a sanctions designation. It'll also tell you whenever there's an enforcement action, regulatory update, anything like that. And so that's generally the first point that identifies an action. And in the recent actions notice, it'll identify that there's, for example, been an SDN list update. Then that will say who has been added to the SDN list. And the SDN list itself, which is the list of specially designated nationals and blocked persons, is a list of all of the sanctioned or the designated entities and individuals that OFAC administers. And companies will subscribe to databases and the like that collect all of this information and incorporate it with their SAP systems and the like so that they can know and regularly screen who they're doing business with to make sure they're not sanctioned. But the list itself is the operative thing. That's where the names get added by OFAC, and that's the thing that gets pushed out to all of those who need to know to comply with sanctions. And then that happens in conjunction, usually, with a press release from Treasury and maybe also from State, and or sometimes there will be separate or independent individual notice to a specific sanctioned party or those involved in a transaction if it's not a broad public sanctions action.
We're not even to tariffs yet, but that can be a challenge. If you have a business, you have boots on the ground, business boots on the ground somewhere, and then a sanction is suddenly placed where you are, or maybe even with the entity that you might be doing business with, or you suspect who is behind the entity you're doing business with. This is a very complicating things for companies. And that's where lawyers can really add value. And obviously having some sort of data tool would be super valuable. What would you say if you were looking at the history of sanctions, what is sort of the outer limits of the president's authority having been exercised here? Is there some particular sanction over the years that people have looked at and scratched their heads and said, how on earth? Because up until tariffs, I don't know that I can conceive of. There's so many checks in place, so many people look at this, big brains, a lot of thought goes into it. Was there something that slipped through or appeared to slip through in the past?
Well, I wouldn't call it slipping through. I will say that historically, you're right that both there are a lot of checks and there's a lot of process in place. And courts are historically quite deferential to the executive branch in matters of national security and foreign policy. So this is an area where both there have been great efforts to try to make sure we do it right, but also judges have been hugely deferential, at least in the past. But one area where, in my experience, I saw more of the sanctions-related litigation, probably related to issues somehow associated with the First Amendment or what's called the Berman Amendment to AIPA. So the Berman Amendment, it has a lot of features that are similar to the issues addressed by the First Amendment. And basically, it carves out of the scope of the sanctions authority the authority to regulate the importation to any country or exportation from any country of informational materials. And so when sanctions actions have kind of skirted up against this informational materials exception, that's oftentimes the point at which we see litigation. And in some cases, the executive branch hasn't always been successful. So that's the key area that I think of where there has been movement and there have been some decisions that implicate the outer bounds of the executive authority under AIPA.
And let's be clear here, we're not talking about information that would direct someone on how to assemble a nuclear weapon or something like that.
We're not talking about information that would probably be export controlled or classified. This is just information. So just like under the First Amendment, government can't regulate free speech. Using sanctions, OFAC can't prevent the export or import of information like books or art or things like that.
Although, depending on the art or the book, you can make a lot of money off of reselling it.
The trade-based money laundering is a separate issue.
Yes, there's no shortage of that. Okay, but let's pivot here because now we're not on terra firma. It's like we're walking on the moon and we've never done it because AIPA is now being used to justify tariffs. And apparently, at least according to what I've read in VOS, it's not entirely insane. There are some things to cite to think there might be a basis. But the question becomes, what is the process going to look like? Is that going to land with OFAC or is that going somewhere else? And to the extent you can, if that process is in another agency, why would that be the case?
Yeah, so since this all relates to ultimately to imports, that process is not with OFAC. And so there are other agencies of the U.S. government that are the front lines of administering our imports. So Customs and Border Protection are the ones that when items come into the country, they're involved there. Department of Homeland Security, and then U.S. Trade Representative and Commerce all have a role. So I won't purport to speak to what those agencies are doing and what the process might be involved since my time at OFAC didn't touch it. But all of those who are normally involved in the import space are the key players in this arena.
But they do have processes in place for other things, and inevitably there will be a process here. So let's talk just a little bit more about what Commerce's role is related to AIPA, even though that may be obvious to some of our listeners. To others, they might have missed that thread.
Yeah, so Commerce, and again, my experience with Commerce is really focused on the export controls piece of it. They administered an AIPA-based regulatory program during the period in which the Export Administration Act wasn't in effect. So they have experience working under an AIPA rubric, certainly in the export control space. And Commerce also regularly engages closely with OFAC from my time there. As we saw just today, the 50% rule was released that BIS is now applying to entities that are on the entity list and other Commerce administered list. And, you know, as you can imagine, that was done in quite close consultation with OFAC, although, again, Commerce's authorities are not now based on AIPA in the export control space.
But have we seen a roadmap for what this process might look like in terms of tariffs? Have you noticed whether or not the administration has released any sort of plan?
There has been the implementation of tariffs, and there's also been the enforcement related to tariffs. For example, recently, DOJ and the Department of Homeland Security announced a new trade fraud task force. So this task force has broad civil and criminal authority to enforce tariffs. Likely, there will be a focus on audits and investigations, perhaps False Claims Act-based civil charges, some criminal prosecution for tariff evasion. And the other thing to remember is that tariffs themselves aren't new. We have tariffs under multiple traditional tariff-related authorities, like Section 232 and the like. And there is an existing process in place to administer and implement those tariffs and to enforce.
Let's talk for one other minute about legal notice to individuals, because I think one of the reasons why these things are published, it's a lot like I think of it in the criminal space as like a charging document. You want to make sure the individual knows what they're accused of so that they can respond. But at the same time, the law is intended to give notice in all contexts of what is acceptable and what people can do. And it needs to be clear notice. How is that going to work for businesses, particularly when it seems like every day these tariffs change? It's kind of like the list of export controlled material, these 23 lists. You need to have something that's like one of those train station signs, you know, when the trains are arriving and they switch to let you know. Do you have any idea what the plan is or how this kind of notice is? It seems like it's helter skelter, but I assume it'll fall into some order.
I guess we'll see what happens. For the moment, for businesses that are impacted by tariffs, and those are businesses that have international supply chains and that deal regularly with commerce across borders, it's recognizing that these changes based on tariffs are here to stay, at least for the short term. There's the uncertainty associated with the tariff-related litigation, but regardless of what happens there, there will still be tariffs. It's really just a question about what authority they'll be based on. Certain authorities do provide more advanced notice than others. IEEPA, historically, when we have a sanctions-related IEEPA national emergency, there's usually a paragraph in it that says no advanced notice is necessary with respect to persons that have a constitutional presence in the United States because of concerns about asset flight. Now, I think that's a different construct than the tariff space, but in terms of the history of IEEPA, there is actually a track record of not providing notice with respect to IEEPA-based sanctions actions. But for businesses that are trying to operate in this global economy, you know, I think the keys are coming up with tools to be ready for these shifts. So that includes contractual provisions and supplier agreements, making sure that they allocate responsibility for tariffs and quick changes in prices or lock in prices for a certain time frame. It also means taking a look at supply chains to figure out what makes the most sense in this current environment so that businesses can make reasoned decisions based on the ever-changing situation that we find ourselves in with respect to tariffs, since I expect there to be more change before there's less.
That sounds right. And I can only imagine with respect to supply chain, they're going to have some redundancies in other countries. Because who knows, just really depends on which way the winds blow, I guess. What are you expecting, if you are, from the Supreme Court's review of VOS? Have you, you know, engaged in sort of a friendly wager, a point spread with anybody yet?
Well, I know better than to try to anticipate what the Supreme Court might do or try to speak for any of the justices, but I will definitely be watching this case closely. I hear that attending the Supreme Court argument for it is the hot ticket in town. And I'll be very curious to see what the Supreme Court decides with respect to the use and the scope of IEEPA, whether they touch on the justification necessary for national emergency declarations in the IEEPA space, the major questions doctrine regarding Congress's ability to delegate certain powers to the executive branch. These are all the questions of the day, and they're such important questions. And so this will be a really important case to watch.
And I have a piece of advice to the young lawyers who are listening to this. If you can listen to the audio of these arguments, it is extremely helpful to helping you think on your feet as well. If you can't listen to it live, I think they kick that out, what, on Thursdays? That will definitely be it. Remember, if you can't be there, you can certainly listen in real time, which is really awesome. Anyway, I really appreciate you coming in tonight. Rachel, do you have any parting thoughts for us on this topic?
Well, I guess we will find out soon if IEPA has additional limits than we've thought, but otherwise, it's been great to be here. And thank you so much for bearing with my deep dive into IEPA and sanctions history.
We love it. Our guest tonight has been Rachel Alpert. She is now at Jenner and Block as a partner. She's the former chief counsel of the Office of Foreign Asset Control. I missed a plural in there, Rachel. Sorry
Multiple
about that.
assets.
That's it. I knew it had to be more than one asset. But we'll be back next week to talk more about the current ways that IEPA is used with friend of the cast, Katie Keedian, former chief of the Counterespionage and Export Control Section of the Department of Justice, now an adjunct at George Washington University Law School. So thank you for listening to NSLT tonight. Remember to talk to your neighbors and colleagues. You could share this episode to facilitate that conversation. Remember to subscribe to us on your listening app of choice. Talk to your friends, your neighbors these days, even people you disagree with, and listen. Consider one another's point of view. Believe me, it will hone your skills as a lawyer and sort of lower the temperature in the room right now in a time when it needs to be lowered. It would be good for everybody. And remember, despite everything that might be happening in the world right now, our national security does depend on our unity, and we still live in a country with wider diversity of thought than any other. The writer, producer, and host of NSLT is me, Elisa Poteet, always here in my individual capacity. My co-producer and editor is Francis Burkham. Our program manager is Antasia Hawkins-Blakeney. Social media support and research support from Alana Coopersmith. And my other co-producer and Skolin's director is Holly McMahon. There's nothing she can't do. She never stops. She never fatigues. It's frightening. And a special thanks to the brilliant minds of the Nonpartisan Standing Committee on Law and National Security, without whom this podcast would not be possible. We'll see you next time.
The views expressed on National Security Law Today have not been approved by the House of Delegates or the Board of Governors of the American Bar Association, and this recording should not be construed as representing ABA policy.